Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show. Welcome. Vermont Senator James Jeffords will resubmit a bill to incorporate alternate transportation fuels, recently defeated in a subcommittee. The American Petroleum Institute calls the plan unworkable. And coal mining in Colorado. Methane gas there has always been a factor in well water, but since mining efforts increased recently, residents say more methane than ever before is seeping into their water.
I could tell when mine increased because the hot water system, the heat drives the gas out of the water and it collects in the hot water pipe, and when you turn the faucet on, it spits at you. And it started getting to where you turn it on, it would spit at you hard enough so it would knock a cup out of your hand sometimes.
Resident Carl Weston, and more controversy brewing over Coors beer. These stories and more straight ahead on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. This is Bruce Robertson. Vermont Senator James Jeffords says he will try again to pass legislation setting a timetable by which the United States begins to use other fuels in addition to petroleum. His bill, titled the Replacement and Alternative Fuels Act of 1991, went down in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, led in defeat by its chairman, Louisiana Senator Bennett Johnston. Despite the defeat, Jeffords remains undaunted.
If I am successful in convincing the Senate that we can be energy independent, and it won't cost the consumers much money, and then I have a strong feeling that I can win on the Senate floor and that we will place this country in a position where it can be energy independent with little or no cost to the consumer. And it's hard to believe. It's almost too good to be true, but we've got the facts to demonstrate it.
Jeffords' bill spells out the timetable by which the nation can begin to use either replacement or alternative motor fuels. Guided by this legislation, by 1998, we would have a 10% mix, and by 2010, a 30% mix of these different types of fuels. Though critics say Jeffords is asking for too much too soon, he takes what he believes is a practical view.
We recognize that gasoline automobiles are going to be around for a long time. So if you're going to get energy independent, you've got to have something to replace gasoline from conventional petroleum.
Jeffords suggests we could do this through the use of either replacement fuels or alternative fuels. Replacement fuels being those that can be burned in the internal combustion engine as it currently operates.
Well, such things, of course, you can add up to 10% ethanol and get your gasohol. That's one approach. You can add methanol. But also you can liquefy gasoline, liquefy coal. And the new technologies that are out on that to demonstrate that this can be done, and you come up with a product which is cleaner and more environmentally sound than gasoline itself. And, of course, the South Africans are totally utilizing gasoline from coal right now, as the Germans did in World War II. So the technology is there, and now they have found ways to make it environmentally okay, so that's another alternative. But then, of course, the side that many of us are interested in, and that is let's look for those fuels which are alternative fuels that will fit under the clean air definitions to help clean up our air, including, and remarkably so, some breakthroughs in the ethanol area, which would even make it a CO2 neutral, that is a non-global warming fuel.
Jeffords says as long as the price of oil from OPEC remains low, now back down around $20 a barrel from the October 1990 high of $40 a barrel, we will not begin to invest in these other fuels. By legislating that we begin this mix, Jeffords hopes to level the playing field, enabling these other fuel technologies to compete with petroleum. But as you might expect, this proposal does not sit well with some.
Well, it's unworkable and contrary to the public interest.
Charles DeBona is president of the American Petroleum Institute in Washington. He says there are several specific reasons why Senator Jeffords' bill never should be enacted.
It would impose very high costs on consumers. It would increase emissions of greenhouse gases. It would do very little to increase energy security. Interfere with efforts that are currently underway to achieve air quality goals under the Clean Air Act. And essentially what it does is revive a discredited energy policy of the 1970s when we created an immense $88 billion boondoggle called the Syn Fuels Corporation. And this is another way of doing the same thing, but without appropriating the money, just imposing those kinds of costs on the American public.
DeBona says those costs would show up right at the pump. For example, for every 7 gallons of gasoline sold in 2010, a gas station would also have to sell 3 gallons of alternate fuels under the 30% mix plan. However, in the case of ethanol, DeBona says making the fuel takes more energy than you get back out when you drive your car. Thus, with the alternative fuel costing more than gasoline at the pump, in an effort to induce motorists to buy the alternate fuels, oil companies would have to raise instead the price of gasoline to offset the high cost of the other fuel. DeBona says if we are going to spend more for fuel anyway, instead of subsidizing these new fuels, rather we should buy extra oil now at the low cost of $20 a barrel and add this to our strategic supplies. Estimating that it would cost $100 to make a barrel of alternate fuel, he says we should take that money and buy 5 barrels of oil. And he says it is simply not true that the Earth's oil supplies are dwindling.
Never has there, in the petroleum history of petroleum, have the reserves of petroleum been larger than they are today. The known proved reserves today are greater than ever in the history of oil,
but
discovery and exploration. They exceed 1,000 billion barrels of oil, and we use about a little over 20 billion barrels a year worldwide. So the known world reserves exceed 40 years supply.
But 40 years in the timeline of civilization is a fairly short period of time.
That is what is known today, and we're discovering more oil each year than we're consuming.
But there isn't
If we did not discover a single additional barrel, we would have 40 years supply. But in fact, we're discovering more than we use. So it is simply not true that the world is running out of oil.
But I guess what I'm driving at is that there is no more oil being made. We may be discovering more, but once we discover and use everything that we know or...
Well, I mean, that's one way of looking at it in some kind of very long-term perspective. But, I mean, we're talking about many, many decades and possibly centuries of available oil, during which time there will be development of alternatives that will become economical, there will be scientific advance that will not cost, as these do, several times what oil does.
The other leading objection DeBona gives to the Jeffords plan is that we simply do not have the refining facilities to process these new fuels. Jeffords, however, would keep the process right where it is already.
We would put the burden on the refiner. The refiner can do it two ways. They can mix the replacement fuels, or they can work on the alternative side by either working out a distribution themselves for those that have vertical systems like Exxon and whatever. They could make fuels available at their retailers and get credit for that towards their percentage. Or we would have a market credit system that says, well, they could get together with a provider of ethanol, they could get together with a producer of electric cars or natural gas for the amount that's sold into the vehicles which are now going to be, which are mandated under the Senate Energy Bill. They could get those credits by paying money and to assist the alternative fuels to come along by helping them with funding. They could buy the market credits which would comply with the percentage requirements.
Senator, this gets at the heart of opposition to your bill, S-716, that critics say refineries are not in the business, they're not equipped technically to make other types of fuels and reformulate gasoline. One critic, I understand, has been quoted as saying this would be akin to requiring dairies to make fruit juices.
Well, you know, when you don't have the facts on your side, you result to high hyperbole, resort to hyperbole and all sorts of exclamation. First of all, the law now requires gasoline to be reformulated. And what we're doing is increasing the amount of reformulation. So all of the administrative mechanisms that are necessary to do with the technical aspects are already required. Oxygenation, all those things. Secondly, mixing in, for instance, gasoline from coal, a synthetic fuel from coal, it's identical product. It's cleaner. It doesn't have the stuff that they are trying to have to take out through the reformulation. We're requiring them to do nothing that they're not going to be required to do under the Clean Air Act or that is being done already. Brazil has done this for 20 years. South Africa completely on this kind of a process. That's just trying to blur the area or cloud the situation. They just don't want anybody to tell them what to do, and they would just as soon continue to be dictated to by OPEC. And you got to remember, the oil companies, when there is an increase in price caused by OPEC, they get a lot of advantages from that, especially for domestically produced product.
DeBona hopes that Jeffords does not reintroduce the legislation. If he does, DeBona is prepared to lobby strongly against it. Jeffords, on the other hand, points out that much of his proposal is already mandated by the new Clean Air Bill, such that by 2010 we would be mixing 7% alternate fuels anyway. He says he is only adding another 3% to that, and he says, seen this way, the question is not can we achieve another 3%, but do we really want to be energy independent in the short term as well as the long? This is Bruce Robertson. Joel McCower joins us on the line now. Joel is editor and publisher of the monthly Green Consumer Letter and co-author of the popular Green Consumer book. In a recent newsletter, you tell us of the Adolph Coors Brewery in Colorado advertising its product as being brewed with the cleanest and healthiest of Rocky Mountain waters has now found itself in something of an ironic position.
Well, we call it sort of a brouhaha going on here that Coors, which promotes its Rocky Mountain spring water, has just recently inadvertently dumped about 150,000 gallons of beer into a creek near Denver, right there in the Rocky Mountains itself, killing over about 17,000 fish. So the companies had to some egg on their face, to say the least, and they've had to pay some fines, although they've been very minor fines, far less than what they'd pay for a 30-second spot on a local baseball game. But they've been dumping some water. Not so clean, it turns out to be. But this is not the first time that they've soiled the local waters. They've actually had some. They've been cited in the past for discharges into local creeks. Not too long ago, they were fined for leaking cleaning solvents into that very same creek. The name of the creek, by the way, another irony, is Clear Creek. But over a three-year period, they'd been leaking some cleaning solvents into Clear Creek, and they got in trouble for that as well. The real irony here, of course, is that for the last year, Coors has been spending several million dollars for an advertising blitz promoting what they call its Pure Water 2000 campaign, which is a campaign to, encourage support for cleaning up water supplies and, of course, give the company a good name.
They have, you tell us, essentially apologized for this bill.
Well, we got a call when we wrote about it, and they said, listen, you know, we're really embarrassed, and we didn't mean to do this, and we cleaned it up, and we turned ourselves in to the authorities because, this is not something where we got some skeletons dug out of the closet. This is just a mistake we made, and I guess it points up the fact that a lot of these companies that are congratulating themselves in the back, patting themselves on the back about what a good job they're doing for the environment, leave a lot to be desired in terms of their own environmental records. We've seen General Motors congratulating itself on 20 years of environmental record when they've been fighting every Clean Air Act and fuel efficiency increase that's ever been proposed. And Coors, I guess, too, shows that they have a lot of problems that still need to be worked out.
Well, all right, Joel McCower, thank you for staying on tap, as it were, editor and publisher of the Green Consumer Letter and co-author of the Green Consumer Book, and we'll talk to you again soon.
It's always a pleasure, Bruce.
Beneath the states of Colorado and New Mexico lies a coal seam with another valuable commodity, methane gas. In recent years, largely because of a federal tax cut, a booming industry has developed. But there are problems associated with the process, one of which is migrating methane. In some areas, the gas is showing up in private water wells, causing concern among area residents. More now from Becky Rumsey in Colorado.
It used to be that methane in coal was little more than a deadly hazard to miners. To oil and gas producers in northern New Mexico and southwestern Colorado, the Fruitland coal seam was troublesome to drill through. It was fragile and full of water. But in the last 5 years, coal bed methane has been the subject of a booming natural gas development in the San Juan Basin. The basin's 7,500 subterranean square miles contain vast caches of gas, oil, and coal. Over 20,000 oil and gas wells already puncture the region, so residents are concerned about the cumulative effects of all the drilling, especially on groundwater.
This little pipe you see here, when I first moved here in 68, that thing was flaring. And the next summer is when the kids start playing around flaring lemonade, but when I realized why it was starting to taste bad, it had gas in it.
Carl Weston's been living with gas in his water for years. His house in the Animas River Valley south of Durango is just across the highway, only 250 feet from an old gas well that leaks. It's not a coal bed methane well, but Weston and over 50 of his neighbors in Colorado and New Mexico say their water has gotten worse since the coal seam drilling began.
I could tell when mine increased because the hot water system, the heat drives the gas out of the water and it collects in the hot water pipe, and when you turn the faucet on, it spits at you. And it started getting to where you turn it on, it would spit at you hard enough so it would knock a cup out of your hand sometimes.
Longtime area farmers say that methane has always bubbled up in wells, alfalfa fields, even the Animas River. But last fall, the U.S. Geological Survey found that the gas in Weston's well increased by 50% in 4 months. The situation prompted New Mexico to sponsor water fairs, and in 1989, when the state found that 25% of the water samples contained methane, they began pressure testing old conventional wells. Then the oil and gas companies went in and cemented the ones that leaked. Jim Beckstrom is an environmental specialist with the Amoco Production Company.
Old plugged and abandoned wells, in fact, have historically been the source of gas problems. Casing leaks are another source. In fact, when we hear of a migration problem, if we're in an area where there's migration, that's the first thing we look at is plugged and abandoned wells.
No one can say for sure where the gas in the wells is coming from, but some engineers think it's linked to the unusual way coal bed methane is produced. In coal seams, water holds the gas to the coal. Typically, a coal bed methane well draws off a lot of water, depressurizing the formation so the gas will flow. But lowering the pressure in the Fruitland coal seam may free the gas to migrate up any nearby conduit, a natural fracture, or an old wellbore. Ernie Bush of the New Mexico Oil Conservation Division.
Oh, I think that there's a relationship, all right. I think that probably would have found its way to the surface over time, but I think that the oil and gas development has exacerbated the situation.
Colorado is also beginning to take the problem seriously, partly because of the work of the San Juan Citizens Alliance, an affiliate of the Western Colorado Congress. In April, the grassroots group won an Environmental Protection Agency award for their efforts to minimize the impacts of coal bed methane development in the San Juan Basin. Last year, with industry support, the group successfully lobbied for legislation creating a Colorado Emergency Environmental Response Fund. The money, which comes from taxes on oil and gas produced in the state, has been used to fix some abandoned wells. But fixing the old wells can be expensive. The Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission spent nearly $100,000 on the well near Carl Weston's house alone. That's nearly half the amount currently in the fund. This summer, the commission will use some of the money for groundwater testing. In conjunction with La Plata County, the commission plans to sample water in a 700-square-mile area that includes the Animas River Valley. Jerry Swingle, president of the San Juan Citizens Alliance, would like to see even more extensive studies done.
We have advocated a basin-wide water testing program, specifically mandatory testing within a one-mile radius of either existing or proposed wells to establish a database.
The San Juan Citizens Alliance is one of several groups that have called for a basin-wide environmental impact study on the effects of oil and gas development. Jerry Swingle.
The only legitimate way to get a handle on what the potential impacts are for this area is, in fact, to take a broad perspective, to take a broad overview, and to look at the cumulative impacts. And to date, all of the federal agencies and all of the state agencies that we have advocated this before have, in fact, rejected that notion.
So far, industry and agencies like the Bureau of Land Management and the EPA don't support the idea. Amoco's Jim Beckstrom.
I think anything that we'd address in an environmental impact statement has already been addressed through the various sundry studies that have been done by the agencies.
For now, industry, citizen groups, and agencies are continuing efforts to share information and to curtail environmental problems as they arise. In May, the San Juan Citizens Alliance asked the commission to prohibit drilling in certain areas of southern Colorado. At its June hearing, the commission will consider public comments on new conditions for drilling permits in sensitive areas. For the High Plains News Service, this is Becky Rumsey in Durango, Colorado.
The High Plains News Service is a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils based in Billings, Montana. Only recently have we begun in earnest to think of water as a limited and threatened natural resource. Pollution and overuse have seriously depleted once seeming endless reserves. Changing weather patterns have in some places reduced rainfall amounts and put stress on rivers, lakes, and reservoirs. Larry J. Wilson, director of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, which has taken a lead in groundwater protection, says water protection can be achieved only through cooperation of every citizen. He shares his thoughts in this radio commentary.
People depend on groundwater in every state. It now provides almost one-fourth of the water used in the United States and provides the source of drinking water for more than 50% of our country's total population and 97% for rural residents. 35% of municipal water supplies, 40% of all agricultural irrigation water, and 26% of industrial withdrawals are from groundwater. In addition, groundwater nourishes and maintains many ecosystems that are valued for their wildlife habitat, recreational opportunities, and fish production. It serves important ecological functions by providing fresh water for many lakes, rivers, inland bays, and estuaries. With the passage and implementation of the 1987 Groundwater Protection Act, Iowa moved to the forefront in protecting this irreplaceable and fragile resource. The Act is a non-regulatory approach to environmental protection. It focuses attention on research and education in the belief that the only rational approach to protection is elimination of the problem at the source. Specific human activities, often resulting from a lack of understanding, have caused the problems, and only changes in these activities can resolve the problem. The localized nature of groundwater resources requires maximum participation and creativity from a partnership of local government, industry, public interest groups, and private citizens. Iowa's mandate to protect and preserve its groundwater resources involves all of its citizens in the active management of the resource through wise choices made in everyday activities.
The comments of Larry J. Wilson, director of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. His opinion is part of a series of radio essays heard from time to time on The Environment Show. Well, that's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed this edition of The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.